Judge Serb is now joining the court, and we've got everybody in and out of the courtroom. So, counsel, Mr. Susie, good morning to you. And Mr. Smith, good morning to you. Do either of you have any questions before we begin Schaefer versus Gable?
No.
Then, Mr. Susie, you may approach and you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, member of the court. This has been extensively briefed in a number of contexts, and in oral argument, I'd like to address three issues. Number one, Schaefer 2, that is pending a final order. I'd like to discuss the issues of the consequences which are intended.
Let's be more precise about terminology. We've issued an opinion in Schaefer 2. There's a pending motion for rehearing.
That's true.
That it's live in that sense, but we shouldn't be mixing final order terminology that applies to trial courts to the terminology that applies here.
That's also true.
I would be interested in the course of your discussion for you to assume that the motion for rehearing is overruled. What effect would that have on this case? And likewise, to assume for purposes of argument that it's not overruled, what effect it would have.
It would have no effect.
And listen to what you have to say.
It would have no effect on the habeas action because it was not decided on the merits. It was decided on the question of procedure in terms of whether or not APA declaratory judgment was available or whether 1983 was available. It never addresses the merits of saying this is how Department of Correctional Services can correctly administer the three sentences that were imposed. What concerns me about that case is the consequences, intended or otherwise, by saying there is no jurisdiction available under the APA to consider issues regarding discharge from custody, which is a constitutional right. You cannot hold someone beyond their lawful date without being in violation of this, of the 8th or 14th Amendment.
And I think you're assuming in your argument that the APA is the playground of constitutional issues.
It's the only one where its constitutional issues is mentioned specifically by the legislature. It is not mentioned in the Uniform Declaratory Judgment Act. Now, if the court wants to graft on that the Uniform Declaratory Judgment Act does address constitutional issues, I'm fine with that. But I can guarantee you that the state is going to argue that somebody tries to do Uniform Declaratory Judgment Act against the prison, it's barred by sovereign immunity. And under the APA, the legislature put in a specific threatened application violates constitutional principles or constitutional rights. In that particular case, the waiver has been done by the branch of government with the authority to waive sovereign immunity, the legislature, not the executive branch, not this court. If that's true, then every prior decision that this court has ever entered in which they have granted an inmate's request was done without jurisdiction. It means that everything that you have built or that everybody relies on is a nullity. And I don't think that's intended in order to take care of Mr. Schaefer's case, that you want to throw out all that case, whether it's for or against the Department of Correctional Services. That's the problem with dealing with that with discovery. It should have been dealt with under a 12B6 motion. Does it state a cause of action? I say this to people all the time. Sometimes the way you can win on appeal is by losing a 12B6 motion before the district court, because it essentially then becomes a motion for declaratory judgment. You go up, you've made specific factual allegations. If those specific factual allegations support your claim, and the court says, no, we're remanding for evidentiary hearing, you have an advisory opinion of I can prove those 8, 10, 12 facts being true, then I'm entitled to relief. The second thing I'd like to discuss, though, would be habeas corpus, which is why we're here. We're here because of the habeas corpus petition, and habeas is different than any other action, whether it's declaratory judgment, 1983, what have you, because it is ensconced in the Constitution. Neither the legislature nor this court can just do away with habeas corpus. Shall not be, what's the language? It shall not be abrogated. My guess is that given when this was passed, that the original Constitution was upset with Abraham Lincoln suspending the writ of habeas corpus during the Civil War. But be that as it may, it's still black letter constitutional law that is in there.
Isn't it shall not be suspended?
Suspended, yes. The legislature hasn't suspended it. It's existed since, 1875 by statute. But you cannot file habeas under all the interpretations until you reach your mandatory discharge date. You cannot file anticipatory habeas corpus. There was an attempt to amend that when they had the repeal of execution. That was a provision of it, but that was then overruled in the subsequent election. And so it still remains the law that you have to be subject to absolute discharge.
Well, that's this case you're claiming. Is that right? That your client is subject to mandatory discharge?
Exactly. He reached his mandatory discharge around January 3rd, 2022. And that is through the application of the statute, which brings us to the merits. The merits, it's been black letter law for over 100 years that a sentence begins at the date it's imposed by the court. These three sentences were imposed in 1979, 1983, and 2017. Yes or no to that question? When you answer yes, that they began on those individual dates, then the problem solves itself. First sentence was completed before the second sentence started. Second sentence was completed before the third sentence started. When the third sentence started in 2017, the district court could have deducted from the credit for time served, the amount of the time served on the first two sentences.
When the resentencing court gave the credit, is this correct statement? The credit was given against the murder conviction.
The sentence that was imposed, it was the only one that she could give. She had no jurisdiction to do anything on the other two sentences. She only had one case in front of her. Mm-hmm. The other two were already done. And if they were already done, she could have, under the statute, deducted that time. She didn't do it. The state could have appealed the grant of credit for time served and said, hey, wait a minute. You gave him too much time. Now.
Is this correct, though, that Mr. Schaefer did attempt to appeal?
He filed an appeal, and then the attorney general agreed with the dismissal.
So there was an appeal from the resentencing order, correct?
Yes.
And it was dismissed.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. That's
but there's no judgment.
Thank you.
All that would do would provide you the time of which LB would apply. So there was no ruling on
the
merits.
The state contends that this is a double dip. Getting credit for time he was serving on one as opposed to with the other case he was serving. What's the strongest argument that he was not getting double credit?
The strongest argument that it was not?
That it was not double credit.
Because it was already granted, and the Department of Correctional Services has no authority to try and fix the sentence that was imposed by the judge. And that's, you've already ruled on that in State versus Barnes. Once the order is final, you're stuck with that credit for time served. You may not like it, but there is no way to get it changed. The order may be erroneous, but the Attorney General's office should have looked at the file and said, hey, wait a minute, this is too much credit for time served. And that happens all the time on appeal. There's at least a dozen or more cases in which the Attorney General's office has raised too much credit for time served as a matter of plain error. And they could have argued it was plain error. That would have been to a huge detriment to Mr. Schaefer, because he would move his date back even farther than what they want to do right now.
Well, what was your, I believe you said, correct me if I'm wrong, that the order in 2017, the resentencing order, could not give credit to the assault conviction.
No, I didn't say it. I said it did. It didn't address it. She could have deducted. She didn't. But she couldn't revisit the assault convictions. Number one, they were in a district court in Lincoln. Actually, they were both in Lincoln. There was nothing she could do about those cases.
Could she have given credit to the assault under 83.1, 106?
She could have given it. She could have deducted it. In fact, the way her order is written, she gave credit over the top. She didn't have to give them credit because those sentences went into effect when they were imposed 1979, 1983. She had no authority to do anything like that. Department of Corrections.
You believe under that statute, she could only give credit to the murder sentence?
She was required to give credit to the murder sentence, not could, required to give credit. And she gave credit from when he was arrested in 1976 all the way up to 2017.
When did Mr. Schaefer serve his sentences for assault?
He served them 1979 to 1980 and 1983 to.
Wasn't he serving a life sentence for murder at that time?
He was serving an illegal sentence. The sentence was vacated, so he's not serving a sentence.
Well, at the time
it existed.
At the time, it was a life
sentence. Well, and it ended in 2016. When it ended in 2016, when it was vacated, Department of Correctional Service and Attorney General's office just said, "Okay, discharging from those two sentences." And then we'll deal with a sentence on the resentencing.
Would you say that under 83.1106(3), the sentence for murder was set aside?
Yes.
Thank you.
That's what the statute reads. And that's required that it is set aside to get credit. But you know, the math problem could have been fixed by the Department of Corrections, could have been fixed by the Attorney General's office. They had the opportunity.
Could it have been fixed in the appeal that was dismissed?
They could have tried to fix it. It would have gotten complicated because the judge was relying on representations made to her about the effect of the sentences and whether or not you stick with the sentence of 70 to 90 years.
A judge always has to rely on the information that's provided them with respect to credit at the time of sentencing, doesn't he or she?
Yeah.
Can't do their own investigation.
No, I agree with that. And this is what she did. And she never said anything more other than this is the credit I give on this sentence. And what I'm saying is those other two sentences went in effect when Judge McGinn and Judge Blue imposed them in 79 and 83. Thank you. I have no time left.
Thank you very much. Mr. Smith, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Police Court, James D. Smith, Senior Assistant Attorney General, appearing for the appellees. There are four separate alternative reasons why the district court should be affirmed, two of which were actually articulated by the district court's dismissal order. First one was jurisdictional priority, that the district court had no jurisdiction because of the pending case in Schaefer 2, which opinion and case was the subject of the court's order for supplemental briefing. Second reason is by the merits on statutory construction. Schaefer is not entitled to a mandatory discharge yet. Third reason, failure to attach the commitment orders for all four of Schaefer's prison sentences is grounds to dismiss. And the fourth would be claim preclusion, which, at least the way I construed it, was the purpose for the supplemental briefing order. The jurisdictional priority, as stated by the district court, was correct. There were two cases pending at the same time in state court, both filed by Schaefer. Both involved the issue of Schaefer's mandatory prison discharge that was filed against the same parties, the prison officials. The district court concluded it did not have jurisdiction because of that jurisdictional priority. Jurisdiction either existed or did not. If not, what we now have is an appeal from a trial court that did not have jurisdiction, which means this court doesn't have jurisdiction.
Jurisdictional priority is a jurisdiction, a question of the authority of the court, or is comedy?
It's authority of the trial court's authority to, just to have jurisdiction over a case when there's another case pending previously filed by the same party that has not yet been resolved. That was the case facing the district judge, and the district judge properly concluded, I don't have jurisdiction under the doctrine of jurisdictional priority, dismissed on that grounds. He appeals, but his appeal would depend upon the district court having had jurisdiction in the first place. The district court was correct in saying it didn't have jurisdiction.
If you're right, and it's a matter of subject matter jurisdiction, we wouldn't get to any of your alternative
cases. That's correct.
Right? The case just goes away, but then presumably, well, if the motion for rehearing in Schaefer 2 is overruled, it gets refiled and we start over? Is that how it would play out?
If it gets overruled, the district court did not have jurisdiction under the jurisdictional priority doctrine at the time the district court ruled because Schaefer 2 was pending.
Jurisdictional priority wouldn't apply after the overruling of a motion for rehearing, because then the other case is gone, right?
The other case is gone, but the district court was still correct.
Right.
He'd have to file another case. Yeah.
So we'd be back where we are.
Probably be back where you are, which then gets into the second one is under the statute, the district court was correct on the merits. By saying the sentence of 13 to 42 years had not yet been served. And you look at the statute 83(1)(106) subsection 2 that provides that credit against the maximum term and any minimum term shall be given to an offender for time spent in custody or under a prior sentence if he's later resentenced. That's what happened. The district court later resentenced the appellant for first degree murder. The district court under that statute was required to give Schaefer credit for the time served, gave him credit for essentially 40 years on a 70 to 90 year sentence. Under the statutes on good time, you would cut that maximum in half, would be a 45 year sentence, gave him credit for 40 years, which was proper. And as of 2017, the defendant had served on the maximum term first degree murder 40 of the 45 year maximum sentence. When you half it, you still got the 13 to 42 left. And so by simple math, you still had a 42 year maximum. You have that, that's 21 years. You still have 5 years left on the murder sentence. That's 26 years left on the max. As of 2022, the defendant had not possibly served that remaining 26 years. So on the merits,
calculation, I think maybe as you've briefed it, is that the mandatory release would be 2043?
Yes, that's the way that's the way corrections did it. The way you would get there is you would take the resentence of 90 year max. You take the 42 years, you add that, that's 132 years when you consolidate the two, which you would be required to do under 83(1)(110)(2). Maximum terms are to be consolidated. So you could take the 90 years, you take the 42 years, you consolidate that, that's 132 years, divided by two, that's 66 years. Judge Luther properly had to give him credit for time served of about 40 years.
That's still the 14,000 days. Is that the 14,000 days?
Yes, yes. Yeah, that's roughly about 40 years is what she did. And that means he still had 26 years left on the maximum sentence as of 2017. He files the habeas 5 years later. If you still got 26 years left to serve on the max as of 2017, you file a habeas 5 years later, at best you've served another 5 years, you still got 21 to go, which is
under 83-1-106. Three, did the trial court set aside the murder sentence?
No, what the court did was resentenced, did not set aside the conviction. What sub two says, you get credit for time served upon resentencing, which is what the district court did, had to do as a resentencing.
But three says, and correct me if I'm reading this wrong, under 83-1-106, three, if one of the sentences is set aside, he remained convicted. One of the sentences was set aside. Which sentence was set aside? The murder sentence?
It was set aside but resentenced under sub two.
Well, don't you go then to number 5B, credit to an offender who's eligible, therefore, under three, having had something set aside, right? Credit should only be given by the court that does the setting aside.
Yes.
Is that correct reading?
I'm reading sub five. It should only be set aside by the court entering such credit. In other words, Judge Luther didn't have authority to grant credit for time served for the other three felonies, which were not set aside, which were out of Lancaster
County. Well, whether or not she had authority, she didn't do it.
No, she didn't do it.
If she set aside under three and she resentenced pursuant to 5B, she gave a credit for that sentence, which she set aside, assuming it was set aside, and she gave the credit as to the murder sentence.
Yes, which is what she should have done.
Did she do that?
Yeah. And that meant that she didn't have any authority to touch the other three felonies, which had the 13 to 42, and they're still there, and under 83-1-11-0-2, maximum terms are added to compute the new maximum term to determine when discharge becomes mandatory, and that applies to committed offender sentenced to consecutive terms, which happened here at any time during the original sentence. When he was sentenced for those other three felonies, that was during the original sentence of first degree murder, which under that statute, all of those mandatory, that 42-year mandatory time on the other three was to be added together. And when she did the resentencing of 90 years, the 42s add to the 90. That gets you the 166. You have that. And essentially, when you do the math, it should come out that he still had 26 years to go as of 2017. 5 years later, he files habeas. He's still got 5 years or 21 years to go on the maximum. So any way you cut it, he wasn't eligible for mandatory release when he filed the habeas. That's the end of the story.
The appellant contends that because the murder sentence was set aside, that he began to serve those assault charges when they were sentenced. Am I understanding that correctly?
I think that's what he's trying to say, but essentially he's just saying the three felonies just simply disappeared. And I would say under statutory construction, under the statutes I've cited, I think what you have to do is resentencing, give him credit for time served, which is what Judge Luther did. And you then have to combine the maximum terms of those, all of those sentences. And when she does the resentencing, he still had 5 years to go on the first degree murder on the sentencing. He still had 42 to go. You'd have 21 to go on the other three felonies. She doesn't have authority just to say, we'll just ignore these other three felonies in which you've been sentenced 13 to 42 by another court. She didn't have authority to do that. She didn't do that. And her sentence, if the statutes are properly construed, that's not what happened, because you can't just, the Board of Pardons can make crimes and sentences disappear, not a district judge, simply by resentencing, when Judge Luther's resentence, frankly, did what the statute said she should have done.
Have we ever said that resentencing moves any consecutive sentences in other cases up in the queue?
I can't think of a top of my head.
Should we?
I don't see any reason you should, because when I look at the statute that says you're to, if you're sentenced to consecutive terms any time during the original sentence, which is what happened, then what you do is you combine all of those sentences to determine the maximum.
So the Q never changes.
No. And then when Judge Luther resentenced, she had to give him the 40 years credit, which is what she did. But to say that, gee, when she did what the statute says, that means three felonies just disappeared with maximum terms of 42 years. And then it's just common sense. I'd say case law. You don't give credit for time served on a murder sentence and say you get a double credit for other felonies. And she didn't do that. She couldn't do that. And those 42 years, they just never disappeared. They're still there. And they had to be consolidated, added together to determine what's the maximum discharge date is. And I'd say the district judge, and give Judge O'Gorman a lot of credit, he got it. His decision on the merits was actually correct. He hadn't served the maximum on the remaining 42 years. If I could, the failure to attach commitment orders, I put that in my brief. It's not the strongest argument, but it's there. Claim for preclusion, I understood the supplemental briefing order to address claim preclusion if it actually, the court was going at jurisdictional priority. I guess I didn't understand that, but my claim preclusion argument, I'm just going to rely on my supplemental brief and leave it at that because of my time limits. The court has any more questions? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal? Mr. Soucy, we asked Mr. Smith a lot of questions, so we'll give you a minute and a half for rebuttal.
Thank you. Is deja vu all over again, because Mr. Smith's argument was the argument I was making in shape of one. I'm amazed. And it's a question that Judge Stacy that you asked regarding moving the two Lancaster County cases up in the queue, so that the first sentence now being served was the Hall County sentence. And then we now have the two Lancaster County sentences to be served at the end of the Hall County sentence. That was the argument I was making in Schaefer 1, to which the state took an entirely different position. It's the first time I've ever heard them say what he said here today, applicable to Mr. Schaefer's case. I would have been tickled to death to have gotten relief under that theory, because it makes Mr. Schaefer parole eligible. And he has the most exceptional record since the last 15 years, and I think he's an excellent candidate for parole. But they argue two different things depending on the exigency of the particular litigation that we're facing. And we ended up with this habeas case based on their arguments in Schaefer 1. So they can't have it both ways. That's my point. If you give us a definitive ruling on the merits, we will then live with it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Counsel, that concludes arguments in Schaefer versus Gable, and you are excused. The next case of the day is Jacob versus Frakes. I am recused from this matter. I believe Mr. Jacob is going to appear by Zoom. Justice Miller Lerman will be presiding, and Judge Serb will also be serving on this panel. And give me a moment to get out of the courtroom.